On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. Jesse Cohenhoven about moral agency, especially as it relates to children. So we cover all sorts of topics like what is moral theory and moral agency, why do we have a tendency to exaggerate the agency of children or disabled persons, etc. Why have studies in the past been systematically biased when it comes to studying children? Should we be cynical about these studies like this? Why has the approach to putting the age of reason, or whatever that means, at 12 or otherwise, come under empirical critique? Why is childhood theologically important? Are children responsible? Are they capable of virtue or vice? And much, much more. As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now for the only analytic, Baptist, and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking. Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and we are a podcast that's dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. And when we talk about that, I always try to remind our listeners, whether they're new or old, what we mean by that. It's not just being very vigorous in our argumentation. It's not just putting down a syllogism or whatever you imagine as like really sophisticated, high-level academic thinking. We also mean a particular sort of posture towards our thinking. And so in an effort to sort of describe that, we've talked about hopefully cultivating an intellectual culture of things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. So that includes the sort of high-level critical thinking that we think everybody should be having, but it also includes virtuous dispositions of being interested in other people, why they think the way they think, and seeking to understand them and why it is that they're saying what they say. We think that James 3 provides a lot of wisdom when it comes to what it looks like to be a virtuous thinker, being open to reason, being gentle, being those sort of things. But on the flip side, we should still be critical and we should hold what we think of as a sort of confession of faith regarding the centrality of the Orthodox Christian faith, as well as broader to the larger Protestant tradition. Hold that cheerfully as it helps to guide and helps us to ask appropriate questions towards various topics. Now, today I'm thrilled to introduce you all to Dr. Jesse Cohenhoven. We are going to be talking primarily about children and agency, moral agency in general. I think this is going to be a lot of fun because I don't know of any podcasts or any resources that are in this sort of format that's accessible and available. And I think it's super relevant. People ask these questions all the time and think about them. I think sometimes people, when they're new parents, they think about them a lot and then their kids get old and they forget about the questions. And so that's part of the reason that that happens is it's a stage of your life. It's not always there with you that you have little gremlins running around your house like I do, where I think about children and moral agency probably just naturally, but I'm not thinking about it in a manner, like a, I don't know, an ordered manner. So this is going to be a lot of fun. Jesse, before we get started talking about the topic in particular, I'd love to know a little bit about you. Where are you at? And then what was it that really sparked your interest in this particular topic?
Well, thanks, Jordan. I really appreciate the invitation to be here. And it's exciting for me to be able to talk about this research that I have been doing for the past few years. Just a little bit about myself. I was a psychology major in undergrad, and I've always been interested in questions about human nature, sort of like what makes people tick, what does the good life look like? But my psych profs told me that my questions were too philosophical and that they couldn't test them empirically, and that maybe I should talk to some people in the religion or the philosophy department. So I did, and kind of like realized, oh, this is what I should do. But I've never lost an interest in the psychological issues either. So I did my doctoral work at Yale. And then for about 20 years now, I've been a professor at Villanova University. But I've always held on to those questions about agency. And I've taken various directions to try to get at those. So my first book was about original sin. And the motivation there was really to ask some questions about what it means to be free and what it means to have genuine agency. It seems to me that that doctrine gets at really interesting questions about how we don't fully control who we are and don't even always know what we're up to. And raises then interesting questions about, well, can you blame people if they have attitudes that they don't control? And some people think of it as a negative doctrine, but I just think it's in really insightful. And so I did work on Augustine with that too. And one thing that Augustine famously says right at the beginning of the Confessions, actually, is that children, babies, when they're sucking at their mother's breasts, they're greedy. And a lot of my students over the years have read this passage, friends too, and they're just not happy about it. Like, Augustine seems like he's being so mean-spirited and cute little babies, and, you know, what, like, why be harsh? And I'm sympathetic. I'm not sure that, like, a newborn should be blamed for vice, which actually I'm not sure if Augustine was actually doing that. But anyway, that passage was maybe the first thing that raised for me this question about, well, what is the moral status of children? And then 10 years ago, I finally was able to become a parent. And then, as you say, you just naturally ask these questions because you tell your kid, well, do this or don't do that. And you end up blaming them for things, or you give them praise. Sometimes you punish them. Sometimes you reward them. And then you're like, well, should I be reacting this way? I mean, they don't know what they're doing. And so I, with my friends and my wife, have just had super fascinating conversations. And it turns out there's been a revolution in psychological research on children's agency and cognition over the past couple decades. And so I kind of wanted to put all of that together to write some stuff on this topic. It's been a fun project. Awesome.
So as we think about children and agency, it's probably best to start at the ground level of just thinking about moral agency in general, potentially how the sort of terminology of free will might interact with that. Does that mean having a choice? I know you have some reservations about that way of thinking, so explore that as you see fit. Though before you do that, maybe give me a like two sentence explanation of moral theory in general and how that fits with Christian ethics, just because I know a lot of our listeners, they're pastors or they've been trained in seminaries, and typically when it comes to these sort of questions, it's under the heading of like ethics. So would you say moral theory and then the stuff on moral agency is separate from ethics, or is that like somehow related to it?
Great questions. Thank you. I think that moral theory is part of ethics, but I also think that as a Christian theologian, it's important not to think of ethics as an independent discipline. I actually think that Christian doctrines of grace and salvation and atonement and forgiveness relativize how we think or should shape in deep ways how we think about ethics. I mean, this is the great topic of the Reformation, right? Merit. And like, do we have any? And what would it mean to say that we do? And so on. And so if your standard kind of like Kant-influenced concept of ethics is you make a choice autonomously and then you get credit for that because it was up to you. Well, Christian doctrines of grace, etc., they complexify all of that a lot, I think. So for me, it's really important that ethics and the moral theory and the thoughts about agency that come out of that have to be deeply theological and shaped by our understanding of soteriology, especially. So does that take care of the first part of your question?
So then when I think more about like moral agency in particular and its relationship to the concepts of free will and choice and things, how are we thinking about those?
Yeah. So my sense, and one of the reasons why I went back to Augustine to kind of educate myself, because I wanted to learn from the tradition. My sense is that we have all kind of inherited a culture of thinking about free will that is what philosophers call libertarian. And super short version of that is libertarians think that in order to have free will or in order to deserve moral credit for something, you have to be the ultimate source of that fact about yourself. So in some sense, you have to be the deciding factor. And that's what it means to be free. And I think in our culture, this is why choice is such a big mantra. I mean, I think there are good reasons to care about having choices. Like a political system that allowed no choices would be probably totalitarian, and that's not so good. But theologically and philosophically, I think the Christian tradition thinks of freedom as something more than choice. Maybe sometimes having a choice is a good or important thing. But ultimately, in the Christian view, the kind of freedom that Jesus has as the God-man, I think theologically it's just super interesting. Like the human nature of Jesus doesn't have a choice. It's selected, right? He's elect. And so he is who God has given him to be. And indeed, it seems that that's the case for all of us as created beings. And the freedom then that one has is to flourish as the being that God has made one to be. So this, I think, is a normed conception of freedom, a conception of goodness, that you're not truly free unless you're good, unless you're able to love the way God wants you to love. And then I think that means then that choice is relativized. It's not the sine qua non of freedom. And indeed, I think it's possible to be free without having choices in circumstances where you have, to keep it simple, the ability to do what you want, where you can act for your own reasons. And that, I think, is the wisdom. That's a kind of wisdom from the Christian tradition that I think, to some degree, we've been in danger of losing.
Yeah.
So that's what got me interested in freedom.
Yeah, my intuitions tend to track with that, to where I don't need to have sort of alternative possibilities. The classic Frankfurt cases have always been quite persuasive to me. But that's, you know, okay, those are apart from even the theological considerations of what it means to be free. So now when it comes to children and the concept of agency, what does it mean for a child to have agency? And would we change our definition of agency when it comes to someone like a child, or someone that we would think has traditionally, when we just say someone is an agent, maybe a disabled person, we feel like they have less agency, or someone, I don't know, there's a lot of different scenarios where we would probably just naturally, intuitively think they have either less agency or no agency. So when we think about it, how should we sort of be explaining it and understanding that?
Yeah. I think that one way to think about the theory of free will and agency that I was just talking about is that it comes in levels of demandingness. So I think the libertarian notion that most of us kind of take for granted culturally is a highly demanding concept of free will. What some philosophers have called agency par excellence. So maybe, I mean, I'm not saying actually that I agree with this, but maybe you could say to be the ultimate source of your own identity, because you made a choice that was controlled by nothing else, maybe that's the most powerful kind of agency. As I say, I'm not sure if I agree with that, but that's a very demanding concept. But it seems to me that there are lots of kinds of agency that matter to us a great deal that fall short of that, that aren't as autonomous or self-creating, but they still matter. And I mean, one way to think about this is, since AI is all the rage now, think about the agency of ChatGPT when it writes a horrible C- essay for one of my students. I don't really give ChatGPT any credit or blame for that. It's just a machine, and it doesn't know what it's doing. It doesn't have a reason for what it's doing. It's just deterministic, like reductive execution, you know? But there's a difference between that and what children do, for sure, right? Even if they can't tell us why they want certain things or care about certain things, like the kind of just natural security they feel if their parent is close by, you know, when they're really young. There's a logic to that, right? And when they run to be closer, or cry if you go away, whatever. There's like a sensibility there. There's an insight that motivates their behavior, even if they can't tell you what it is. So I think there are all these different like levels of agency. And one mistake we've made is having an overly simplistic all or nothing kind of dichotomy, where if you don't have agency par excellence, then maybe, you know, you've got nothing. And as you say, I think that's actually led us to ignore the significance of a lot of different sorts of agency, including the agency of the disabled, and maybe of non-human animals. That's a hot topic these days as well. And definitely of younger children, it seems to me.
So if I recall right, there's been quite a few studies on at least agency of children in the past. And I think, you correct me if I'm wrong, you would say that a lot of these studies in the past have been sort of systematically biased in some way. Should we be cynical about most of the studies that have been done on children in the past? Why or why not? Do they have resources that are useful in some sense that provide us some true aspects of how what it means to have agency as a child?
Yeah, I do think there are reasons for concern. You know, all of the, as maybe you know, the social science has been going through a crisis over the past couple of decades. Often people call it the replication crisis, which is a way of talking about how it's hard to repeat certain classic studies. If you repeat them, you don't get the same results, or you can't get the same quality of results. And so people are sort of wondering, how good is this research actually? Was it just an accident that certain studies showed certain things? But beyond that, I think there are reasons to have reservations about some of the older foundational research in developmental psychology. So big figures like Piaget or Kohlberg, stuff that you know you typically learn about in your intro psych classes. Turns out that their way of trying to figure out what children were capable of was oftentimes, I mean, it's not that they have nothing interesting to say that we can't learn anything from them, but a lot of their research was too demanding, researchers now think. And so it kind of fell prey to this dichotomy I was just talking about, where if you can't do all the really cool stuff that a supposedly normal full-grown adult can do, then like you're out, and you don't have significant agency. And some of the stuff that they asked children to do was just hard. Like famously, Kohlberg was trying to figure out what moral stages of development children were at and at what ages. And the way he tested this was by asking moral dilemma questions. And one of his most famous ones was a guy, I think his name is Heinz, and his wife has a debilitating illness, but he can't get medicine, the medicine he knows will help her. He's too poor. But he does know that if he steals, he can get it. He can sneak into the pharmacy or whatever and get it. And so the question then is like, what should Heinz do and why? Well, that's a grown-up has trouble with that one. Like, it seems like you kind of feel like you should say he should steal, but then stealing is wrong. And so like, is it a tragedy? Or like, what are you supposed to say about that, right? And Kohlberg had a certain kind of Kantian line that he wanted people to take. That was for him the highest stage of moral development, following certain universalizable moral principles. Well, I mean, most grownups can't tell you about that unless they've had an awful lot of ethics, right? Like, who uses this language, universalizable moral principles, whatever? So not surprisingly, younger kids, especially like really young children, you know, like they had nothing to say about this. Like, I feel bad for Heinz, you know? Okay. But what does that show? Like, what has he proved there? You know, not too much, it turns out. And so more recent research is just much more subtle and nuanced. And so there's been a whole host of studies, for instance, involving not a lot of talking, because, you know, not surprisingly, 3 to 8 year olds, they aren't always that good at conversation, which they find boring, as my 10-year-old son has made clear to me. Too much talking is boring. But playing is great. and they're fully engaged with that. And so they've done all this great research with distribution of simple goods like cookies or stickers. And you play a game where maybe some puppets that are with you playing the game, they get some of the stickers, but other ones don't get as many. But then you, the kid, you get a lot, maybe. And then the researcher says, like, what do you want to do? And it turns out in really high percentages, the kids want to distribute things fairly. And they want things to be equal. And they feel bad if they watch a little play in which a puppet is mistreating another puppet. And they try to help out the puppet that's been mistreated. And they'll avoid playing with the puppet that's doing the mistreating. Well, so, I mean, that's all pretty interesting, right? Like, that is a great example of how we can know stuff without being able to talk about it. And the ability to know more than we can say. Pretty cool.
Yeah. So has there been a sense in which some of the more empirical studies of late have pushed back against sort of this idea of there being an age of reason of sorts, where at some point, whatever the age is, 8, 10, 12, 14, where suddenly you reach sort of like this maturity level of where now you can reason. Prior to that, you couldn't. It seems like what you're describing here seems to push against that. So it would be more of like, well, they don't have the ability to verbalize it, but it's still latent there and operating in some respect.
Yeah, this is, I mean, the short answer is that people are still really interested in something like an age of reason because they want to have a line where they can say, like, hey, children are now responsible agents and they have free will. And so there have been arguments among at least certain more philosophical figures in the field doing the research about, like, what is the new age of responsibility? And the consensus is definitely that it gets pushed back. So the older line was a lot of times drawn around the age of 10 or 12. And now I think it's pretty widely agreed that it would more likely be 6. But then some people think it's actually 3. And so my view is there's something, I think you were implying this, there's something screwed up about thinking there's one age of reason that, like, ta-da, you've got it now. As there are all kinds of different lines that we cross. And this is partly why being a parent is sort of both fun and hard and frustrating, because you're like, well, what am I supposed to expect of my child at this point? And am I being fair? And they change super fast. And so it's hard to know. So I don't think it's wrong to have some kind of theory of broad stages. And this is one thing that some researchers have been trying to offer that I think is helpful. They've realized that individual development is so varied that you can't just say 2-year-olds can all do X because they like, as you know, right, they can't. And you don't want to make parents feel like, oh, my child is a laggard and there's something wrong, you know, because it's just not the case. But what they've ended up doing is offering these kind of bands of development, like 2-year increments where, well, generally speaking, in this period, children tend to develop these sorts of abilities.
Okay. Yeah.
But I think theoretically, it's really tricky to know then how to think about all that. And there's a lot of work to be done, kind of like reprocessing this idea that there are probably multiple ages of reason.
So it seems like when you're a parent, that there's a little bit of an ease in being like, there's a range here, but there's also the legal question of like more greater matters of greater importance. Say somebody kills somebody, you have to have like a black and white, this is the line. Is there a sense in which, or there's a 14-year-old steals something, or I can imagine a whole host of scenarios where a child does something bad that should be morally responsible. Has the empirical research at some point said adulthood, so to speak, should be also pushed back before 18, or is 18 still sort of the agreed upon, that's the standard we should have?
Yeah, that's a really interesting issue. I have not seen any psychologists who want to have anything to do with intervening in the legal discussions about agency. I mean, I do think at some point, as the research becomes more solid. It may have implications. But I would also say, I mean, people want to err on the side of don't ask too much, because the legal thing, it's not flexible, right? And so you have cases like this. Just a few months ago, there was a crazy story about, wasn't it a six-year-old kid or something who brought a gun to school and shot their teacher?
Yes, I vaguely remember something along those lines.
And the parent ended up getting charged for negligence. For this, which seems like the right move. Because certainly whatever agency six-year-olds have, understanding the implications of a gun and what it can do, that's pretty hard to comprehend. So, but I think most psychologists aren't as much interested in the legal implications of their work as just the interpersonal aspects of it. And I do think it's important to maintain a clear difference there. I mean, one way to talk about this is to think about the difference between the interpersonal attitudes that we have with each other of blaming or praising and questions about punishment. I think questions of punishment should be connected to these questions about agency and deserved blame, but they're separate. Because when and how you're going to punish somebody depends on a whole host of other considerations, like what's affordable and what do you think might be effective and which audiences are you trying to communicate with? And so all these questions about punishment are bigger than these interpersonal questions about blame, it seems to me. And so there's some kind of complicated gap.
Well, here's a real life concrete example. I just got a text message from my wife right in the middle of this interview saying that she came downstairs from putting my youngest to sleep, who is 5 months old, and my middle son, who's 3 years old, stole the bag of chocolate Santas and ate every single one while she was upstairs and was covered in chocolate with a pile of wrappers. What band of agency is he in when he's making this decision to go eat all the chocolate at Santa?
That's really funny. I have a similar story about my son has two younger cousins who live right near us. A few years back when they were four, they got into some paint in their playroom. And yeah, exactly. Made a big mess. And the adults were in a different room. And one of the two cousins, they're twins, so the same age. And the girl twin comes into the room with us to say hi and maybe can I have a snack or something. And she's got like paint on her face. And we all look at her and say, hey, where did that come from? And she immediately said, my brother opened the paints. So we were like, okay, so clearly she knew like this was wrong and it's better to get the blame on somebody else, you know? And my view is that starting around three or four, we probably can properly blame kids for their implicit knowledge. I mean, in my story, the girl Mia, she could talk about blaming other people, which is pretty interesting, I think.
Yeah.
But I don't know. What's your sense? I mean, when my son was three, we had the sense that there were a number of occasions where he was quite clear that there was a line and crossed it quite deliberately, partly sometimes to see what we would do. Like, if I get away with this, that'll be awesome because then I can continue. You know, like how weak are my parents?
Yeah, I get the sense
like a test.
I very much get the sense my three-year-old's in this weird testing phase, but finding out where the boundary lines are and everything. Though my five-year-old, like you mentioned, where your example where you can blame somebody else, even if you weren't theoretically taking apart. My five-year-old's very much in that stage. I feel like a couple of months ago, my middle son again decides to turn on the water faucet in the bathroom in his room upstairs, dumps all the water all over, and who knows how long this is ongoing. My wife comes in and there's water everywhere, which ends up going through our ceiling and dripping all over. So I have to like replace my drywall and everything. But my oldest just stands there the whole time and is like just having the greatest time. But when my wife, you know, confronts him, it says, oh, well, I didn't do it. Ezra did it. I told him not to, but I just stood here and like, you know, sort of like took part in the act, though I wasn't actually the one, you know, taking all the water out. So it's very interesting to me. Like you've mentioned these different, it does seem there is a real sense in which there's different stages of development and agency.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, there are a couple of really fascinating things here. Some philosophers have wanted to say, well, when we blame children of this age, 3 to 5, 3 to 6, whatever, it's not really moral blame of a responsible and accountable agent who has something like free will. It's just like a useful training device. So what you want is less of that behavior, and they want to please you. So if you show disapproval, they're more likely to stop. So this is kind of like a consequentialist take on parental blame and punishment. I've asked a bunch of my parent friends over the years about this, and they all kind of recoil and say, no, that's not what I'm doing. Like, the kid clearly deserved it. Like, they knew it was wrong. Don't tell me they didn't. And I think that this gets to really interesting questions about moral theory and what you think has to be possible for a child in order for them to count as morally blameworthy. And, you know, this really famous psychologist, Michael Tomasello, has one of the more clear accounts of what to make of a lot of this research. His argument has been, children are not moral agents until they're at least 6, because it's not until that age that they can conceptualize moral rules as such. And for him, that this means an obligation that stands over you as something that's expected of you from your larger group. So not just the individual opinion of like, my dad likes this or my mom doesn't like this or whatever, but rather a sense that this is how things are supposed to be. And then the sense that I knew that, but I did it anyway. And I think that seems to me like the kind of Kantian view that I'm sort of pushing back against. I think that's too demanding.
Yeah.
I mean, that is one aspect, that's an important aspect of morality, right? The notion that there's a rule and am I going to abide by it or not? But I think even for adults, a lot of what happens for us morally, it's not about, like, I know there's a rule and am I going to follow it? But it's more about relational respect or value or love or lack thereof. And our sense that I'm doing what's befitting this relationship. And that's a kind of a maybe more virtue and vice language or something. But I think that's what parents are responding to, especially in the cases where, you know, maybe you've told your 3-year-old before how to deal with food or what's acceptable in certain ways, right? And so when you find them having eaten all the chocolates and getting it all over the place, a lot of times what a parent says is, look, we've talked about this before. Like, they know they're not supposed to do that. And I think the knowing that it's wrong aspect there, maybe it's not a Kantian kind of rule, but it's a relational violation. Like, my mom asked me not to do this and she has her reasons, but I didn't care. And that, to me, that still seems like a moral relationship.
Yeah. Would you say, I don't know the answer to this at all, but it seems like the psychological literature, by and large, sort of assumes a Kantian framework.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I think the developmental psych people who've done this testing have, I think, typically been pretty explicit. I mean, they don't go around saying, like, I support Kant and not Mill or whatever, but they cite a lot of Kantian philosophers, neo-Kantian philosophers, they don't always give a definition of morality because that's not their job. They're psychologists. Like, who talks about that? Philosophers. We're not a philosopher. We're scientists. So, you know, actually explaining what your conceptual work means, they don't always think of that as their job. But some of the better people do, like Tomasello, and he and others have been pretty clear, I think, about the kind of Kantian framework that they're presupposing. That might partly be a pragmatic move on their part. Like, this is a demanding one that if I can prove kids can meet it, then like everybody will agree that they meet it. But I do kind of think that it's blinded the researchers to some degree, the fact that they're not familiar with alternative options and that they don't always take seriously the moral significance of the emotions or inarticulate attitudes that aren't rule following, but nevertheless, I think in everyday relationships, we consider them important.
Yeah. So thus far, it's been, I've asked you a lot of psychological sort of questions, studies empirically based. In your mind, how does the theological literature or tradition have, what kind of resources and conclusions does it bring to this discussion? Does theology, by and large, assume that children are responsible? Does it think that they are capable of virtue and vice? Is it conflicting in any way with sort of the empirical studies?
Yeah. Well, this, I think, is really interesting. One reason that I think theologically it's important or worthwhile to be interested in children is that children are used as metaphors for the Christian constantly in the Bible and in the theological tradition. So before our Maker, we are children of the Heavenly Father, etc. And so one reason to be interested in the psychological research from a theological perspective is just that this is a image of the Christian that is pervasive, but maybe hasn't always been explored that much. It's sort of like, yeah, we're supposed to have childlike faith. I mean, that's nice. But I actually think there's a lot of worth to thinking about the ways in which children are both powerful and deeply dependent creatures. And so this brings me back to my soteriological themes, right? We depend on grace, like children depend on the grace of their parents. We are like that before God. And I think there's a tendency to have a kind of hubris about the power of our agency as adult human beings that maybe we can complexify or chasten in certain respects as we think about, it's my view that we're more like children than sometimes we want to admit. And so theologically, that's a really interesting point of connection for me. It seems to me that we don't always have as much control over our identities as we might like to think that we do. And so if we think about the ways in which children have agency, even though they're not fully in control, or sometimes they're quite ignorant, et cetera, then that can inform how we think about ourselves as well, as we realize some of the overlaps between what they're like and what we're like.
So in your mind, when it comes to the agency of children, does it make a really big difference in your mind if they have more agency than we thought? Does this have like a lot of cash value for whether it could be parenthood or other, I don't know, other scenarios and situations?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think about like the theory of agency, all the fancy terminology, you know, talk about alternate possibilities and stuff like this. It can seem pretty intimidating sometimes, especially if you're not deep in the philosophical literature. Like, what's the difference between significant freedom and just regular or whatever? You know, some of these terminologies can be complicated. But I think it's really important then to keep in mind that questions about agency are like an everyday practical matter for us. You know, we're constantly making these sorts of decisions about praise and blame, about each other and about children, etc. And so I think that it's really significant to go deeper into these kinds of issues because of their practical significance for just everyday human life. And our attitude towards children, I think, is a really important question. Like, are we being fair in our assessment of children? And I think that there's certainly sometimes a tendency to be dismissive of children. I think, I mean, before I became a parent, I didn't, you know, dislike children. But sometimes I think I probably found them incomprehensible And one of the things that being a parent has made me realize is the amount of detailed and careful attention that it takes to understand. I mean, of course, with children, it's funny because, of course, all of us were children at some point. So it's not really fair or accurate to say that they're a different form of life or something. But we can forget so easily what it is to be a child. And the kind of training that we need to have to learn to attend carefully to a kind of part of human life that's so different from the adult expectations and habits. That kind of attention is, I think, really helpful for all kinds of things. And if we get better at it, it might help us understand other sorts of ways of being too, different ways of being grown up. Maybe it can give us a kind of a patience for being sensitive to the forms of agency that are maybe all around us, but sometimes we ignore because they don't speak the language that we expect them to speak.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
So here's a question I doubt that you've been asked in your research, and you can punt it if you want, but I think it's interesting. And I imagine a lot of our listeners would be interested to hear your take on this. So I'm going to give you a little bit of backstory. In most Baptist churches, it's not as simple and straightforward of when a child becomes a member. You know, if you're in a different sort of ecclesial mindset, you're born sort of into the community in some sense, and maybe you have a confirmation period, maybe you don't, and there's a set age. In Baptist life, it's not so clear cut. It's sort of like whenever they become a Christian, and I think most Baptists are fine with them becoming Christian at any age. But then they have like sort of that secondary question of when should they really become a member of the church to be able to make deliberative decisions of, you know, budgets and who should be an elder and who should be a deacon. And oftentimes there's been, children shouldn't have the responsibilities and duties of membership because they don't have maybe the cognitive capacities for it. I've always tended to think that children have a lot more intuition and knowledge than we give them credit for. And just because they can't vocalize it doesn't mean that they can't be a very strong judge of character, whereas we can sometimes overlook a lot of the things that children wouldn't overlook. I'd be curious, based on your research, do you think there's any empirical evidence to say that, you know what, maybe there shouldn't be these sort of like warning signs that children shouldn't be allowed to do these various, what we would consider more adult cognitive decisions, where maybe they should be given an opportunity to participate in the life of the church in these ways?
That's super interesting. I was raised in a Plymouth Brethren congregation that was committed to believer baptism, and actually was very irritated at how long I was forced to wait before I was baptized. So maybe some of that is playing a subtle role in the background somewhere here, like defending my youthful frustration. Like, hey, come on, like I'm ready. I know enough. I do think that I think this gets to a really interesting overall theme that, again, is not just about children. I think that we tend to overestimate the importance and power of a certain conception of rationality and a kind of like articulate ability to express certain kinds of logic. I mean, one way to talk about this is people talk about like emotional intelligence versus more propositional forms of intelligence. There are forms of insight that maybe we sometimes downplay because they don't meet a certain conception of what it means to be cognitively gifted. And I do think that I think I, at least in my own life, have learned, I've ignored those things at my own peril. And in those ways, I do think it could really be great to make a place for children. I mean, there are very hard decisions that churches are faced with about finances and stuff like that. And probably, you know, that doesn't play to children's strengths. So maybe, you know, you don't want them to vote on stuff like that. But to give them a role, to find a place for them in the congregation. I think that's a really interesting idea, to think about how to play to the kind of strengths that they do have. I mean, they tend to be, you know, sometimes just brutally honest in ways that can actually be helpful. Adults can't bring themselves to say certain things. Kids just say them and everybody's kind of aghast. And then they're like, well, but it's true. And as you say, sometimes we're really good. We're so good at strategizing about what we want ourselves to think that we can talk ourselves into things. Whereas a lot of times children are more direct and in a funny way, then less likely to get confused. You know, a lot of parents learn to trust their kids' instincts about people. Like, well, my child likes this person. And that ends up counting for a lot. And I think it's not just because you're like, my child's the best and whatever they say goes or something like that. It's because you have this sense that children actually do have insight. Yeah.
And I've wondered how much of that insight also comes from adults sort of being less hypocritical in those situations when it's around children, to where they almost let their guard down and act like their true selves.
Yeah.
And make decisions because they think, oh, the child doesn't understand or won't remember or these different things.
I think that's right. And then the kid is like, hey, something is going on here. Yeah.
Well, this is super interesting. So tell me, I know you've had a huge, long Templeton grant. I imagine there's a lot of outputs that are coming from this. Are there things that you can direct our listeners to say, this book or this paper or these things are going to come out and we should be looking for it in these venues?
Yeah. So I ran this grant for 5 years, just concluded in this past August. It was a $5 million grant. We supported about 17 different research projects. And a few of them connect with some of the stuff I've been saying about children. So my friend Elizabeth Cochran, who's at Duquesne, has been working on disability and agency. And another friend, Jennifer Hurt, who's at Yale, has been working on non-human animals and agency. And I think Jennifer just published something in Zygon on non-human animals that I think is a nice kind of like summary look at the topic. And I've got some stuff in the pipeline, so I can't say for sure where it's going to come out, but I'm hoping we're trying to put together a focus issue for the Journal of Religious Ethics. And I'm hoping that one of my pieces on children will come out there. So, but yeah, we'll have to see.
Excellent. Well, so listeners, what I'll try to remember to do is whenever these things do come out eventually, remember to retroactively go into the notes here and add the stuff for you so you can click the links. But whenever you're listening, you can just Google the stuff. I mean, Jesse's last name is unique enough to where I think you can find anything that's related. Are there any other Jesse Cohenhovens out there?
No, not in the age of Google, it turns out to be a big advantage to have a weird last name. So yeah.
And lastly, remind me, I know you have a faculty page. Is there another location people can go to follow along with your work or anything?
Yeah, I try to post, because I've received so many emails over the years from people who can't get through firewalls for research, especially in countries outside the US, I try to post my research to academia.edu. I don't want to take all the power away from the publishers, so I don't post things immediately. But within a year, I try to put all my articles up there. So that's a place to look.
Perfect. For stuff. Excellent. So, Jesse, this has been great. I really appreciate you taking the time to walk us through all this stuff. This is a lot of fun. I guess one last question before I forget. You're at Villanova. Do you supervise PhD students?
I do some, yeah. My home department is an interdisciplinary humanities department that is undergraduate focused. But I'm also an affiliate member of our theology doctoral program and a member of the ethics subfield there.
Okay. Perfect. So thanks. This has been awesome. And everybody's been tuning in. Go ahead and check out all the work that he's done, including the original book on original sin. We'll have to talk about that at some future date. Should be a lot of fun. So thanks, everybody listening, tuning in to the only analytic Baptist confessional podcast on the planet. And we'll talk to you guys soon.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.